I'll invite the speakers up to the table and open the floor for questions.
I have what may be a naive question. So why not just tell the government what file formats you will take? Why is that not an appropriate approach?
The Dutch do it. No, the Danish. Yeah, the Danish.
And the Dutch.
Yeah.
Don't the National Archives in Australia have a fairly rigid... Yeah, fairly rigid line about what they'll take with government records, at the very least. I've got no position apart from I seem to remember having that discussion with somebody.
I might just answer it in a slightly different way and broaden it. It's often the question that's posed to artists that should the institution impose a set of file conventions onto artists and only accept artworks that conform to those conventions, or should they migrate various incoming conventions to that standard set of conventions? The criticism that's often posed, and I take no particular position here, but the criticism is then posed that it's the institution constraining the artistic practice by imposing such conditions. So it is different. It is different, but you know, where does the line begin to blur?
I think it's a good idea to try and have some sort of framework of what's acceptable, because that will reduce your possibilities. And I think with what we do with the oral history at the State Library, or any audio, born digital audio that comes in as a file, is we have a fairly rigid set of parameters that we accept, which is a uncompressed .wav file format, 24-bit, 48 kilohertz for oral history, for example. But if somebody comes in with a recording of, you know, some key interview, and it's been recorded on a little handheld thing with horrible data compression, and it's the only recording of it, then you have to. And you know, things like those records about, you know, earthquake disasters and whatnot, it's like, well, if they happen to be on that, then what are you going to say? You're going to say no? Mm. Mm.
So I think, we can guide, and I don't know what position we will try and take in future. I think we do want to be up at the decision-making end of what you want. So you set up a framework about what's acceptable. Or you set up a loose framework and say, do it in these well-known, you know, do it in open source formats or do this. But there's always going to be a requirement to use something else. You know, if Visio costs money, you need a different format. If, I'll do it myself. If I want to do something in a format, I want to do it in the format I want to do it in. And it might not be your basic word processing task. It might be LiDAR. It might be, you know, what government agency are we dealing with? Yeah. And the
computing, yeah. I mean, you know, things like documentation, stuff like that, programs themselves must be the sort of things that will be ingested, I guess, possibly in the future. And you don't want to constrain people to use a particular language. You've got to choose the best thing for the job. I don't know.
And the Royal Commission is evidence, you know, there's evidence submitted. So like the example you've described. AV stuff, images, all 3D, sorts.
Yeah.
So that's submitted from all sorts of organizations and individuals. So if you can't control what they're submitting, maybe you can control at least the system that it's been put into and the metadata that is recorded with it. Mm. And I think that would be a good start.
Wasn't there a survey of metadata of ways to get stuff out of the various document systems, the enterprise document systems? And when Sarah was working with you guys, and there were no standards around it, really, right?
Oh god, I don't know if it was a survey about how to do it.
Yeah.
But I think we learned about a number, I might get in trouble. But there was something like 40 different content management systems. And if you think about that number, each one will have a different export capability.
Hi, my question's for Stuart and Ian. I notice in your research project, your next stage is to convert or make some of the games that you're making playable on the web available to things like touchscreen devices.
I wonder that
you realise what a beast you've bitten off, because instinctively as a games developer, I'm sitting next to one here, a keyboard mouse input device is necessarily much more complicated than a tap swipe device, and converting these ancestral games across into a format that is playable on these devices might be something that you think is achievable, but I suggest possibly may not be.
I think we had a discussion about this with the Play It Again project about strategy going forward, especially with the memory archive, making some of the games playable on that, especially some of the more unique Australian and New Zealand games. And I guess that we have to perhaps choose carefully as to which ones we decide. So, like, The Hobbit has got a virtual keyboard, looks like it would work quite well, he said naively, on it. But some of the other games, it just won't translate, or it'll be like, I have to pop up this virtual control here. Actually, that occupies all the screen space that I've got, and now I can't see the game. So I think it will just be taking a selection of games, and that will be one of the criteria for selection. So that's a really good point.
And following on from what Ian was saying, obviously my area is human-computer interaction, so I'm very interested in exactly what would actually port across. So I do some work with games at the moment because I also co-teach some games courses with some of my media design experts, and looking at exactly what kind of games, as Ian said, you know, what kind of games actually translate across, what kind of interactions would scale across. You got a joystick, for instance, which only really had horizontal and vertical movement in some of the really old games. Would that actually translate to tipping a iPad up and down, and seeing whether or not that is actually an acceptable form of interaction.
Can I just go back two questions, which was about the guidelines. I noted that IASA. You stated that they have set up a series of guidelines of, you know, I presume this is a non-enforced process, but they've somehow initiated a series of standards that have been embraced by the community. Can you talk about that and how that model was established and how it works?
I think primarily by getting together in forums like this year upon year upon year, and then all of the people who are interested in particular areas getting together, probably at the pub, and talking about all of their challenges, and then, well, that's from my experience of going to those conferences. At the end, once all of those sort of guidelines have been put in place, and then that sort of led into building the technical committee. And then they felt that, you know, in order to guide other organisations who are asking the same questions over and over again, so we're not constantly reinventing the wheel, that it might be good to start putting together some guidelines. And that sort of came up with their various technical publications.
Peter, I'm just going to actually add something to that. I went to EASA for the first time last year when I was in Vilnius, and I talked about some research around multi-platform and archiving apps and other kind of interactive audiovisual stuff that Matthew Davies from the National Film Sound Archive of Australia, who worked on those audio preservation guidelines, and I and some of our other colleagues there had been doing. And Matt really wanted to take that kind of research to EASA because they came from a predominantly linear, time-based, audiovisual around the world archives. And so the multi-platform stuff was really interesting to them. And we've continued, because some of the people that have been involved in writing those guidelines are based in kind of national Canberra cultural institutions, We've continued some of those discussions. And one of the discussions we had a couple of weeks ago was around this, okay, this video preservation standard guideline that's been talked about for God knows how many years now, many. And there's another one called... five-letter acronym, can't remember it. FADGI, F-A-D-G-I. The EASA one will come out in some form, but one of the other discussions is, sure, we can set up these video preservation standards, which is great for, again, the digitization is kind of distracting and still dealing with the past, the far past in sort of media terms. But what's going to happen when we get, you know, a phone video of the Cronulla riots? Are we going to say no because it's on the crappiest version of the first phone that ever had a video? No. And it's also, from a researcher's perspective, that's culturally important that no one was recording video at that time. So, I mean, these are the same old discussions that have happened on every format since people tried to start keeping things, I'm sure.
Yeah, yeah. The thing that's key about those guidelines is they just that, they're guidelines.
Yep.
They're not standards. They're not enforceable by anyone. But it's a point where you can sort of look at and go, all right, this is what everybody else is doing. How relevant is it to my institution and my material?
Yep.
And then you sort of like go, well, okay, that box has already been ticked. I'll just follow what everybody else is doing because then I know that somebody's already done the hard work on it. What's different about my stuff? Is it different? Is it same? Do I need to then, you know, create new standards, guidelines?
Yeah, and I would say that's the point, that those new guidelines or those new principles around, sure, if you're not digitising or if you can't do high quality production because you're shooting video or creating audio for a rich media ebook, you're never going to... you're working with a local media company, they may not capture and they may not do another shoot just because some library or archive wants you to suddenly get a higher quality video. And so what are these other guidelines that can set out principles for best practice that are better for people using consumer or prosumer equipment? And I guess that's, Ross, well, I'm chasing you down after this, but all those questions and all those issues you've brought
but
up.
But it is a lot about migration though.
Yeah. And I think you make a good point, though, too. Migration is nothing new for archivists.
No.
It's just that the close... I can't remember how you described it, but the distant past, the close past. I mean... Yeah. I mean, if we'd be backing up to nitrate film if we all knew what was good for us, because we know it lasts 100 years. But archivists have been struggling with migration for a long time. This is nothing new for people who were brought up in a film archive environment. So I think there are a lot of established guidelines out there. I think people have freaked out a little bit, and I think some of the key bodies like FIAF are struggling to know how to incorporate those existing guidelines into a braver, newer world. But they will get there. And they have a very rigorous structure around forming technical teams that address some of these problems. I'd also urge you to look at the EMEA, stuff coming out of EMEA, the Association of Moving Image Archivists in the States, who I think are slightly more nimble than FIAF. And they're certainly addressing a huge number of the born digital issues. I think we've got time for one more question.
Hi. Thanks. So really interesting papers. I found the one about compact disc kind of deterioration fascinating and terrifying.
Yeah.
And I wondered, it seems like a simple question, but that might be out of ignorance. The simple answer might be no, you don't know. It might be drastically different. But I was wondering, as someone who owns a lot of PlayStation 2 games, how related these issues are to, say, DVD discs or Blu-ray discs? Do they have very similar issues or are they drastically different?
Similar. And particularly with any of the recordable types. I don't know the exact differences with when you go into Blu-ray and all of that sort of stuff. I haven't really looked into it. But, you know, they're similar. Those similar sorts of processes, those lamination of different layers of stuff. And, you know, that they... And clearly, they all have that polycarbonate disc which can get scratched, and then they've got the reflective layer which can also be damaged and whatnot, and you know they're metals, so they're you know, unless they're gold, you know, you do have those archival discs which are gold, which are archival discs, but you know,
I think the rules, the standard rules apply. Keep them in a stable environment, keep them well protected, keep them away from dust. I mean, if nothing else, you'll have different rates of expansion and contraction of the various strata. So, you know, nothing is permanent in that sense.
Never has been.
No, that's exactly right.
Yeah, I think, you know, preservation's really, it's all about keeping multiple copies, because, you know, one copy is no copy, as Kevin Bradley always says. And migrate as soon as you can, as soon as you know that there is any potential issues, start putting in place a migration plan. In fact, just have a migration plan in place that you're ready to jump. You know, you might not know what the actual plan is until you get to that point where you have to, but just know that it's got to be there, and that's part of your plan.
Fascinating and terrifying. I think you summed up this session in two words. Thanks, everyone.